Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the future of spiritual practice. I'm Terry Patton, and as you know, I convened this series to help us participate actively and responsibly as individuals in a critical time in the evolution of human culture and consciousness when a crisis is upon us. By convening a deep public dialogue about the inner work that we can do in order to play a key outer role also in helping humanity and our communities and us each as individuals rise to the challenges of this time and transition to a sustainable, fulfilling, and compassionate human presence on our planet. We've had a series of adventuresome and enlivening, probing conversations. A lot of diverse perspectives have already been surfaced here. And this morning, I'm delighted to be joined in conversation by Lynn Twist in a dialogue entitled Changing the Dream. Lynn Twist is a global activist, a fundraiser extraordinaire, a speaker, a consultant, and an author who has dedicated her life to global initiatives that serve the best in all of us. She has raised hundreds of millions of dollars and trained thousands of fundraisers to be more effective in their work. Lynn has spent more than three decades working in positions of leadership with many wonderful global initiatives. She was one of the original staffers at the Hunger Project when it was first founded, and then served as a leader for 20 years, during which time she created and managed the worldwide fundraising operation. And in the process, she met and worked with a great many spiritual teachers. She worked closely with the ontological processes of Werner Erhard, but she also worked with Baba Muktananda, Guru Mai. She spent time in India and elsewhere with Mother Teresa, worked with Bishop Desmond Tutu, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and many more. So she was always involved both in the inner and the outer work, and as she traveled the world learning how to work in a multitude of different cultures, she developed profound wisdom about people's relationship to money, the way it governs and dominates and stresses our lives. And she brought the stories and insights from those experiences into her talks and workshops, and they're the foundation for her best-selling and award-winning book, The Soul of Money. And then more recently, with her husband Bill, she co-founded the Pachamama Alliance in response to a request from the Achuar people of Ecuador. And Pachamama's mission is to empower indigenous people of the Amazon rainforest to preserve their lands and culture, and using insights gained from that work to educate and inspire individuals everywhere to bring forth a thriving, just, and sustainable world. And many of you may be aware of two important initiatives created by the Pachamama Alliance. One is an inspiring educational symposium called Awakening the Dreamer, which is devoted to bringing about an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, and socially just human presence on the planet. And 4 years ago, a campaign to build a global movement of commitment and action that will cause a positive tipping point in humanity's future by the end of 2014. I have tremendous respect for Lynn's amazing service and leadership, but speaking personally, what I have been touched by most about Lynn is her unconditional openness, her loving heart, and her immediacy and presence. She's always so real, so right here with me and with everyone. And what I feel about her is just perfectly expressed by a quote from Pema Chodron that she uses often. She reads it every morning when she takes people to Ecuador on expeditions that connect with the Achuar people. They're pretty adventuresome. It's pretty deep bush. And every morning there's a moment to read this passage, and I think it really expresses Lynn's intention in being. If your everyday practice is to open to all the people you meet, in every situation, and to every situation you encounter, without ever closing down, if you can really do that, then you will learn all the teachings that anyone has ever taught. So it's a total delight to welcome you, Lynn, as my guest this morning. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's a delight, an honor, and a joy to be with you today.
Well, wonderful. You know, as I've told you, this community and I have had the privilege of engaging with many of the premier spiritual teachers and thought leaders of our time, and some of our guests have emphasized the importance of direct activism, but others have counseled us that the first priority is to drop deep into the well of consciousness and love that's our real nature, and to just let that naturally shine forth in whatever way it naturally does. That relaxing our agendas is kind of the first step to really showing up authentically. Now, I often say that I don't think we can rise to meet the challenges of our time without a renaissance of spiritual inspiration and practice, that somehow the inner and the outer both have to really coincide. And since you've been such a long time and effective activist who's been profoundly spiritually inspiring to so many people, where do you think we can look to find the inner resources with which to rise and serve our world in this time of building crisis?
Well, first of all, thank you for the series, the privilege of being part of this stream of wonderful guests that you've had, and also for the way in which you are positioning the dialogues, and thank you for this question. I actually don't know that I have a formula of any kind. In fact, I know I don't. I just know that sometimes we distinguish between the inner and the outer in a way that generates a false dichotomy, at least for me. I'm also aware that that sometimes I and perhaps others get caught in a belief of first we have to develop our inner life before we engage in outer action, or first we have to take care of our own before we move out into the world. I don't have that kind of rule. To me, it's just engage, involve yourself, look around you, see what moves you, what touches your heart. Turn your complaints about the world, which we all have, into commitments. Transform them into commitments, so that things that are bothering you, that upset you, that rile you, that touch you, that move you, those might be yours to transform. So I don't know if I'm really answering your question, but I'm all about participation and engagement for myself. And in my interactions with other people, one of the things that I love to inspire and encourage and create openings for is people to step forward, not to hold back, not to be afraid, not to have the kind of first we have to's that stops them from engaging in a world that's clamoring for their participation, for their heart and soul, for their love, for their vision, and for their commitment. And so I may not be answering the question you're asking, but that's kind of what comes up for me to say the way I at least conduct my own action. And I don't know that it's a recipe for anyone else, but I've been successful as far as I can tell in inspiring people who are hesitating or holding back to kind of jump forward, to take a leap, to take the risk, and to get engaged. And I think that's really important in this time in history.
Beautiful. So that someone taking that admonition to heart might feel that the kinds of engagement that they already have, because I think most people do, you know, no one is completely non-activist. You know, there are gestures that everyone makes. Are there particular directions that you are especially inspired to encourage people to consider opening to as activists?
Well, I think it's really to each his own. A little bit, as I was saying in the last minute or so, I actually think if people really listen to their own heart, not their mind, but their heart. Some people call it an inner voice, an inner guidance system. Some people call it divine guidance. whatever it's labeled, there is an intuition, an instinct. And I really do feel, for me, that every human being that's alive now has a role to play, that there's not a big role or a small role. And every human being alive today in this time in history has a unique role to play. And it's my, you know, it's my understanding, or at least my view, that the job in life is to find that unique role and to play it with all your heart. Play your heart out, so to speak. However that is for you. Maybe that's sitting in meditation, for a month in silent retreat and cleansing and purifying your own heart. Maybe that's jumping into the protests in Bahrain and getting out in the streets and putting your life at risk. Maybe it's becoming a teacher and really engaging young people and children today in this special pivotal time in history and having them recognize the privilege that it is to be alive at this time. But for me, we are living at a pivotal time. Perhaps every generation has said that. Never mind. I know it's true now. And, you know, our 4 years Go campaign, which you referenced, is one way that I participate in awakening people to this special time in history, this pivotal time in history, this turning point. I mean, you opened with the statement that the world is in crisis, and I really believe that that's true. It's also a world that's rife with opportunity and possibility that's greater than the crisis. No matter how big these crises are that we see, social justice crises, spiritual breakdowns, and, you know, moral breakdowns, environmental crises beyond what we could have imagined even 30 years ago, and economic, people call it economic crisis, you know, one of the hugest breakdowns in recent history. But to me, it's all one crisis with multiple expressions. And it's a crisis in our own consciousness. It's a crisis in our consciousness about who we are as a species and the opportunity of crisis, as the Japanese, or I think it's Chinese character is. It's a huge opportunity. And to me, the possibility is way greater than the crisis, even though the crisis is bigger than any generation's ever faced. The opportunities that we have, the possibilities that live, are almost beyond our comprehension. And so this sort of paradox is the beauty of our time and will allow us as a species to literally evolve, to be conscious, as Barbara Marx Hubbard, who I know has been on your program, would say, to be conscious of our own evolution and consciously foster or foment the evolution of our species. And this is just an enormous task and an enormous privilege to be engaged in that in whatever way it calls to you. And I really think there's a calling now, a calling for every human being that's alive. I'm sure this program is part of that calling. I would call it that anyway. And if people begin to hear their own calling and follow that, they'll do exactly the right thing. They'll do exactly what's needed. You know, there's this wonderful quote, I think it's Harold Thurman or Harold Whitman Thurman. I can't remember exactly the name. But it's, don't ask what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive, what makes your heart sing, and go and do that. Because what the world needs is people whose hearts are singing and people who've come alive. And that quote for me really says, in many ways, the answer to your question. If people actually follow the deepest calling of their heart, there will be exactly the right number of people taking exactly the right number of actions in exactly the right areas of concern and crisis and opportunity. And so I have a deep, as you can tell, kind of trust that there's a wisdom afoot in the universe, and if we tap into it, we'll find our rightful role, our rightful place, and we'll take right action.
Well, I resonate intuitively with everything you've just said, and and without really pulling away from that resonance, I feel an obligation to voice a dissenting perspective that has certainly surfaced in conversations I've had before, in which people say, well, yeah, but I know this fellow who got all inspired about the potentials of biofuels and got involved in trying to legitimize corn ethanol, and now we've created this market where the price of corn has gone way up, and it's really hurt the food market, and there are people suffering huge increases in the prices of food in poor countries around the world, and this guy thought he was doing wonderful service, and he was inspired by it, he got involved in the technology, and he just hadn't thought things through well enough. And isn't it important that we do think things through, that if we just operate so intuitively, there's an awful lot of room for us to think we're helping and maybe miss the mark. That doesn't that count too?
Yeah, absolutely. So I completely agree with that. I don't mean to act without discernment or act without collaboration, act without some diligence. I think that that's really important. I was involved for many, many years in the work of ending world hunger, as you said and as you know. And one of my great heroes is Dr. M.S. Swaminathan, who was one of the fathers, along with Dr. Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Prize for this, of the Green Revolution, which was the discovery of, I think it's called IR36, a particular kind of rice that is genetically created or modified in order to produce increased yields of rice. And in many ways, Dr. Borlaug and Swaminathan were lauded for the Green Revolution, which saved, many people say, a billion lives in Asia. And now the consequences of that kind of monoculture, planting a particular kind of rice that withstood insects and rodents and flooding and all kinds of terrible things that wiped out rice crops before, the consequences of that are huge for the soils of those places where that rice was planted. So now Vandana Shiva and others look back on the Green Revolution and call it a tragedy, when in fact, during the time that that Dr. Borlaug and Dr. Swaminathan had really come up with this incredible breakthrough, it was called a miracle. So I'm using that example for myself as I say this. At the same time, I have a view. I'm not saying this is true or false, but I'll make an assertion that if our intention is in the right place, we'll even make the right mistakes. That even the mistakes will inform us in a way that foments our transformation and ultimately our evolution. And that gigantic problem now with those soils comes after a billion people who would have probably died, most of them children under five, are now adults dealing with the transformation of that problem. But they're alive and well and able to do that because they made it through what would have been a massive starvation. So I have a view, and maybe it's too Pollyanna, maybe it's too idealistic. I'm sure people could say that, or even naive. I say it's practical. I say it's practical to know that if you are coming from intentions that are pure, and that you keep checking, and that you collaborate with people who perhaps in an area like biofuels know more than you do, that we'll even make the right mistakes as we, if it's almost like, you know, when you're climbing a mountain, or where you have an intention for a particular outcome, which is the highest and best good, you take many different routes, and some of them are dead ends, and then you have to go back and start again, or where you thought you were going to make a left turn, you take a right turn, because there's an obstacle that you can't get through. So if our intention is clear and we're focused on the outcome that's the highest and best good, we find our way even through failure, even through mistakes, even through missteps. And so, yes, we need to think things through. Yes, we need to be discerning. Yes, we need to do anything and everything we can to be aware of consequences that are unseen and unknown, of actions that are new and innovative that we didn't know those pitfalls would come. Yes. So that's all a function of a profound responsibility that comes with these huge possibilities. That's an aspect of the profound accountability that comes with taking bold, audacious, committed action. That's a part of being guided both in the way that I am suggesting by the heart and the mind, as Angelus Arian would call the braided way. And I know from fundraising, which is really an amazing discipline for me, it's almost, you know, I was thinking before we started, it's almost like a spiritual practice. When you asked me in our pre-call, do I have a spiritual practice? And I said, not really. I realized maybe it's fundraising, because fundraising is an example where, your commitment needs to be higher than just getting the money. Because if you just go for getting the money, you do things that you regret. You manipulate. You do things that aren't consistent with the very problem you're raising the money to resolve. And that's been really an incredible discipline for me to deal with the hard, cold reality of money in a way that is consistent with the profound commitment I have to transformation. And putting those two things in the same space has really sobered me, so that I know that you can't only follow your intuition and instinct and your heart, as you were pointing out. You must actually condition it with the reality that is perceived through the intelligence and the collaboration of the mind. And with other people who know more than you do about whatever topic you're trying to resolve. So, you know, my answer to your question is your pushback. I agree. At the same time, we can get caught there and not take action. And that is, you know, there's a kind of a push and pull here. That is what I call the great dance of being on the edge of the sword. And that's the beauty of our time. No one knows the real consequences of social media. But right now, it's like this huge, you know, kind of miracle generating all kinds of possibilities that we didn't even know were possible. And I'm sure there's consequences that we can't see that will show up eventually. But that doesn't mean we throw out the baby with the bathwater. We explore and foment the new possibilities and discover the pitfalls, discover the shadow side, discover where we might be wrong, discover where it might be hurtful in the action, and not hold back too much so that we don't get started. And I think that's a really, really difficult dance, but one worthy of humanity at this point in history.
Well, it sounds like this dance that you're describing, which it seems like a very deep matter, is a and particularly the guidance that you're offering relative to it points to the challenge that we all feel, because there's such an avalanche of information that it's very often hard for us to be confident that our interpretation of things is really complete, because almost every one of us is to some degree just doing a constant sort. There's all kinds of interesting and potentially relevant information that floods us, and we can only let in so much. And in the choices that we make, we sometimes probably feel a little like maybe we don't know. And in that sense of you know, appropriate humility, there may also be a little bit of implosion, a little bit of a sense of being defeated in our desire to really know what's best, and that can dent our confidence in our ability to take appropriate action and help to bring about a kind of depression in which we don't feel like our gift, because we're not sure that it's absolutely going to be high leverage or really make a big difference. We think it maybe doesn't matter so much, or that if we don't do it, it's not so consequential, and something in our sort of beginner's mind faith that our gift matters is injured or minimized, and that this mm-hmm. inner work of coming to have faith, well, I'm here and I care, and what I can do really matters, a coming to that. That may be a bit of a dance. I think it's sometimes it's quite an ordeal, but arriving in a yes, in a kind of confidence and certainty so that we can give our very best shot, that's perhaps a piece of work you're pointing us to.
Well, that's a great way to put it, Terry. I think I'm just in the presence of something that I just attended that really kind of blew my mind that I'd love to share with you. And it kind of points to a real world example of what you're talking about. In the context of our campaign called 4 Years Go, which is really about having 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, these next 4 years really turn the tide, really be the pivot time in the trajectory of the human family going towards a unsustainable, inhospitable, dangerous future, to shift that trajectory to a hospitable, sustainable, nourishing, peaceful future. Not that everything would get resolved, but to shift the trajectory, the direction in which humanity is headed in the next 4 years. And I can talk more about that. But I had an opportunity to speak at MIT Business School to a group of 90 very, very successful CEOs. And I spoke to them about the 4 years go message, that the next 4 years very well could determine the future of life in the next 1,000. And that's really what many, many scientists and pundits and historians they've said there's a window, and no one knows how long it is when some things may become irreversible. But it's pretty clear the next 4 years we could, and we have the opportunity to create a positive tipping point before a negative cataclysmic tipping point forces action. And whether you agree with that or not, it's a really wonderful way to live the next 4 years of your life. So I was presenting to a group of business people. They're all CEOs. They all have authority and ownership of their own companies. And many of them were very inspired by the message and took it into their soul and heart. And one of them was just this amazing guy who really, really, really got it. I just saw him light up like a candle. You know, when you're speaking to a group and you see somebody light up like a candle, it's so exciting. So I after the talk was over, he and I had a conversation, and he told me he was the largest manufacturer of electric trucks in the United States and also in Europe. And even though his company is relatively small, he was the largest because, you know, there wasn't a lot of competition at this point. And he really got, and he was producing like 12 trucks a month or 15 trucks a month in the United States and maybe 20 trucks a month in Europe. And he really got that this next 4 years, he could shift the ball game. He could really do it. He, this relatively small company, could shift it. And that encounter that we had was maybe in April, May of last year. 3 days ago, Wednesday, February 16th, he invited me to come to the Electric Truck Summit, which he called the Table 20. It was in Kansas City. He got together the 20 largest companies in the United States that have gigantic trucking fleets, like FedEx, who has 90,000 trucks, Frito-Lay, 40,000 trucks, UPS, I don't know how many trucks, Coke, Pepsi, these huge fleets of trucks. FedEx was there, UPS was there, and he said to them, you know, he sort of presented to them, here's the deal. Here's what we're emitting with our diesel trucks and our, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of trucks on the road going all over the United States. Here's the consequences of that. If we convert to electric, here's what the emissions reduction would be. You know, he gave all this incredible information. He had someone talking about peak oil. He had someone there talking about the political consequences being dependent on OPEC in the Middle East. He had investment bankers talking about clean tech is where everybody wants to put their money. He built such a remarkable case with all of these companies. And then he said, you know, if we all go for it, rather than waiting for one of us to begin the conversion to electric, if all of us commit to it today and we begin the conversion now, it lowers the risk, it builds the future,
it shifts the dial. It changes the game. And so I am challenging us to do this together. And I will build. I will make my company so effective if you choose this path that I will be able to deliver thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of trucks with the orders you give me today. I'll build new factories. I'll hire new people. You know, he made it incredible promises. And he had also raised a lot of capital before this meeting. And he had me at the meeting to deliver the 4 years ago message as I had delivered it to him a year ago so that they would hear the kind of larger context in which this huge business decision could be made and the impact it would have on the world and future generations. And I asked all of them to, you know, say, I said to them, do you guys have kids? Most of them were men. There were two women there. Do you have kids? Raise your hand. I asked them the names of their children and their ages, and I said, let's bring them into the room. And really, before the end of the meeting, they were convinced totally of the economics by the CEO of Smith Electric, who had called the summit, and the several testimonials from some of the companies that had already started some modest conversion. And they were convinced with the, you know, the kind of political and environmental reasons to do it. And then, you know, I kind of went into the heart and soul of the matter about future generations and their own children and their children's children, et cetera. And by the end of it was a one-day meeting. By the end of the day, all 20 companies made the commitment to do the conversion. This is a huge deal. FedEx has 90,000 trucks on the road, for example.
Fantastic.
This happened 3 days ago. And I'm telling you this because what caused it to happen was the stand, the commitments, the confidence, the unyielding, unhesitating, uncompromising stand of the CEO of this small and now soon to be very, very, very big electric truck manufacturing company. And he stepped out with such confidence, with such unmitigated resolve, with such determination. He got his ducks in order. You know, he brought in the investment bankers. He did all the numbers. He worked on all the incentives. And he was so effective in doing this that President Obama actually came to his factory, endorsed this whole thing, sent a message. And you may remember in President Obama's State of the Union speech, he said this amazing thing. He said, in 4 years, and he used that exact phrase, I want 1 million electric trucks on the road in the United States. And this really comes from interacting with this man, Brian Hansel is his name. So I'm really answering your question with a story, with an example that is so fresh for me. I'm still, you know, like in the euphoria of witnessing this happening, where the whole industry now made a commitment that's going to move not just the dial of their own company, and these are big companies. I mean, just think about Pepsi. But the dial of the whole industry in the United States, and these are global companies too. So I witnessed once again, and as we all have, the power of our own giving our word, which sounds like a mere promise, but what it does is it galvanizes the power of the self, the power of vision, the power of who we are, and out of that we generate the kind of confidence that creates the future. And so I just know that if we are committed to shifting the ball game, if we're committed to having the world that we really know is the world that we all want, that nobody would disagree with, at the very most fundamental heart of who we are, and we're at work to make that happen, and we're giving our word, making that the promise of our life, the confidence comes with that. The strength comes with that. The intelligence comes with that. It's almost like when you take a stand. This is something that Archimedes said 2,000 years ago. Give me a place to stand, and I'll move the world. And you can and you will. That's what Mahatma Gandhi did. That's what Martin Luther King did. And when we talk about confidence or discouragement, you know, I know that many people are discouraged today. And one of the jobs that I think I have, and hopefully I'm doing it now, is to lift the veil of discouragement. because discouragement is really just being disconnected from your courage, discouraged. And courage is an act of heart. It comes from courage, the French word for heart. When we're discouraged, we're disconnected from our heart, from the courage that comes from our heart. And you can lift that veil of discouragement when it shows up. And you know, deepen your resolve, which is what this amazing guy did, Brian Hansel and Smith Electric. So I just know that anyone, it doesn't take intelligence or education or smarts, can transform ontologically the way they're living their life by taking a stand. And I think that's the gift of our time. That's really what the 4 Years Go campaign is all about, inviting people to take a stand and then finding from that stand the confidence and resolve and determination that is their path, their action, their unique contribution. So anyway, I'm so glad I had a chance to share that totally cool thing that just happened, because I think the whole world should know about it.
Yeah, that's like a bulletin right here from the front. Thank you, Lynn. I'm inspired hearing that. That's wonderful.
It's a game changer, real game changer. And whether it makes the press or not, it's going to change the game.
You know? So this is really helpful, particularly the way you summed it up, this whole matter of connecting with our courage rather than being discouraged. And I think that one of the most generous ways, you know, when I think of trying to give, help people get as much of a gift as possible from this time with you, you're just a remarkably self-actualized human being. You know, you've for years and years traveled the world giving your heart in a passionate way. Tremendous gifts have arrived for an incredible range of people, some of the poorest people in the world, some of the richest, and everybody in between. And yet, in many of the conversations that I have with people who come to me for help, you know, they don't feel self-actualized in this way that you're such a beautiful example of. You know, they're struggling to find how to get traction or what their unique gift is or how to give it. And even people who are on the move and doing good work often feel that they could be doing more and feel some sense of frustration, or like they're kind of hitting the target, but they're not hitting the center of their bullseye. And so I wonder what you've learned about this process of traversing the ground from, because you've worked with a lot of folks who've been inspired by you, and you've mentored others who've seen your example as an inspiration. You know, what wisdom or advice could you offer folks who would love to find their own way to living a more lit up and effective and self-actualized life of service? Especially if they're, you know, they're not, maybe that, you know, they have to hold down a job, or, you know, they have significant responsibilities, so they don't have unlimited resources of time or money.
Yeah, well, that's a really beautiful question, and it's also a conundrum that everybody deals with, I think, anyone at any level of the economic spectrum, in any culture. You know, watching what's happening in the Middle East, for example, is, after all those huge, huge years of massive oppression and control and domination, to see this bubbling up now, it's almost like to pay attention. You know, this sounds so kind of simpy, but I really think it's both simple and highly practical. If you pay attention to the openings, just as the quote that you read at the very beginning from Pema Chodron, that's kind of my daily practice quote. If your everyday practice is to open to all the people you meet, to all the situations you encounter without ever closing down, if you can really do that, that will take you as far as you can go, and that will allow you to learn all the teachings that anyone has ever taught. That's free. That's not a workshop. That's not something you need to go and take time to do, and in a, you know, some setting in a hotel room, like taking, and I do recommend workshops, and I do recommend the landmark work, for example, which I think is the best ontological work in the world. I do recommend the workshops of all the teachers you've had on this call. I do recommend all of their books. I do recommend all of their websites. I recommend the Awakening the Dreamer Symposium for awakening your gift. I recommend the 4 Years Go website for awakening your gifts. I recommend all of those things. And I also recommend paying attention to where and staying open and listening for guidance and asking for it. You know, we whether you have a belief in God or you're religious or you're spiritual or you're agnostic or you're an atheist, if you ask for guidance for that which is greater than your own ego, even guidance from yourself, even guidance from your own unconscious, you'll actually get it. And if you pay attention to what's opening around you and move towards it, that which touches your heart, for me, that's the touchstone, what's authentic. Authenticity, in my view, is where power really resides. It doesn't reside in money. It doesn't reside in how many people you're in charge of. It doesn't reside in your personality or charisma. It doesn't reside in your intellect. Real authentic power, the kind of power that really changes the world, I think resides in the heart and soul of your own authenticity. Is it real for you? Does it really touch your heart? Does it give you chills? Does it bring you close to tears? And that is trustworthy. Not tears because you're afraid or sad, but tears because you're moved. And even the word moved has us move in the direction of the soul, in the direction of what I'll call the authentic truth for us. And so I recommend just that simple quote that I said, and living in what Brother David Stendelrast, another one of my great teachers and a man I deeply respect who's in his 80s, is a Benedictine monk who is the living embodiment and the greatest teacher in the world on gratefulness.
He was on our series. Yeah, we had a wonderful dialogue with him from Austria, I think.
He's Austrian, and he lives in Ithaca, New York, and he's a hermit and a Benedictine monk, and he's an extraordinary teacher, and he has a website called gratefulness.org, and I recommend everybody to go to your archives to get whatever interview he had with you, because I'm sure it was a doozy. He's just spectacular, and he's one of my closest mentors and teachers. And Brother David lives in gratefulness, every minute, and has very few possessions, is in his late 80s. He's a icon for me of how the simplicity of life, to kind of relax from or disengage from all the stuff that we think we need. You know, my work in the Soul of Money Institute is a lot about discovering this distinction called sufficiency or enough, which is not necessarily an amount of anything, but a way of seeing, a way of being, standing in the great fullness of your own selfhood in life. And I say that's available to every living, breathing human being at any moment. And I really think people will give up anything to make a difference with their life, if they know they can. And so for me, the answer to your question isn't a recipe, I hope. I don't want to give a recipe or formula, but to provide environments or contexts or clearings or ways of seeing and thinking, or questions even, that one can ask themselves, that takes them out of the humdrum, burden of the everydayness of life, which is critical and important, and we must be responsible for that. We need to earn a living. We need to take care of ourselves and our family. But to do that in a context much greater than what you think you need or want, but what you're actually committed to, and to live what I call a committed life. And a committed life is a life where you're governed by what you're committed to, not your wants and needs and desires. What you're committed to wakes you up in the morning. What you're committed to tells you what to wear. You know, my commitment to the end of world hunger was a ridiculous commitment for a 29-year-old young woman to make with three little kids. But when I made that commitment, it galvanized a life I didn't even know was available to me. And that commitment then began to govern who I was, what I did, where I went. And my petty concerns that had been so important to me fell into the background because they were petty, they were self-serving, and what moved into the foreground was making a difference with my life, and it ended up nourishing my family, nourishing my marriage, nourishing my health, nourishing my capacity to find my path, and it took me places I never dreamed I would go. It gave me a relationship with Mother Teresa, for God's sake. Who could have ever arranged that? So I say that if you really are paying attention and see and discover what you're committed to, really committed to, and put that in the forefront, everything else dissolves into something that will empower and support the fulfillment of that. And then you don't make decisions any longer. You've already chosen. And it helps to govern and guide. It becomes a North Star. So I don't know if that answers your question or addresses it at least, but I think that's available to everyone.
It's a wonderful response, Lynn, and I hope you appreciate that I'm just trying to go right down as deep as I can into all of this, and in order to really, you know, make this as truly useful an offering to those who get a chance to hear it as it possibly can be. I find myself thinking about fear and survival because in your writings, you know, I've read The Soul of Money, and it's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it, by the way, to anyone who's listening. You'll really get a wonderful shot of Lynn and her stories and wisdom from it. A lot of what you go into there deals with people's insecurities, people's fears of, about their security, their survival, issues about power, and a lot of those concerns are being stimulated these days. And although you speak about that a lot, I know there might be some folks who hear what you just said about that commitment who, well, I'll express the most exaggerated, cynical voice. The most exaggerated, cynical voice might say, well, yeah, you might have been 29 and had young kids and you made this transcendent commitment, but you were a privileged person with a fair amount of wealth and you were able to do that without feeling like your own security was threatened. When somebody's really struggling and feeling like their needs are hard to fulfill, like, you know, I'm feeling like I'm in a bind and I can't take care of my kids the way I want. They're not getting what they need. You know, this sense of having a commitment that goes beyond myself, just isn't that a luxury that people can only get to when they feel a certain distance from those things pressing on them? And I think that each person who is trying to liberate themselves is dealing with some measure of, I don't know if they would express it quite the way I just did, but something in this trade-off between, you know, yeah, I have enough and I can give, or gosh, I don't feel that I have enough. And you speak so much about enoughness. How would you speak to that existential question in another human, I was going to say another human heart, but maybe it's even more like another human gut.
Right. Well, let's see. I'll just see if I can tell a story because maybe that'll be more illustrative than kind of giving an answer. When I first got involved in Ending World Hunger, I actually thought that I was going to be working with people that I used to call poor. And when I say I used to call them poor, when I ended up really having my hands in the dirt with women in Ethiopia after the 1984-1985 famine, who'd lost many children of their own to starvation, or working in Mozambique after the 16-year civil war, or working in India or Bangladesh dealing with the constant floods and massive poverty, I realized that to call people poor was such a misnomer, and that there's nothing poor about these people. In fact, some of the most resilient, some strongest, some of the most innovative, creative people I had ever had the privilege to meet. And that their circumstances are poor, but not them. And when we call them poor, we demean them and ourselves, and we create a relationship that's so inauthentic and inappropriate. And they're whole and complete people, like you and me, dealing with the ebb and flow of the conditions or circumstances of poverty and hunger. But they're not poor. In fact, they're simply extraordinary. And they exhibit more courage to live through a day than you and I are going to need an entire lifetime, or maybe even have to call on an entire lifetime. I also, given that I'm a fundraiser and have been since I was 5 years old, have had the opportunity, especially working on funding the Hunger Project and the commitment to end world hunger, knew that I wanted to, you know, deal with people who I used to call rich. And when I got in real communion with people that I used to call rich, I realized that that's a terrible thing to label people rich, because they're also whole and complete people living in the ebb and flow and sometimes tyranny of excessive resources. And when you really get inside of some of our wealthiest families, there's addiction, there's abandonment issues, there's abuse, there's all kinds of suffering that isn't so visible in the designer world that they live in. That, you know, but they're isolated in darkened windows in the car and big fences around houses, and have lost the privilege of rubbing up against the sandpaper of life, which trains us, which humbles us, which gives us a real character. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that the Hunger Project work was just so profound for me to realize that some of the happiest, most transformed, most amazing people and most joyful people that I have had the privilege to spend time with are the people who are in the biggest, most horrendous, challenging situations, some of the people in resource-poor circumstances. And their experience of their enoughness, their sufficiency, the wholeness of their families, the love and communion of the village, the security that comes from their relationships with one another rather than having anything, because that's you don't have anything to depend on, so your security is really your relationship with one another. And then in this most recent chapter of my life, working with indigenous peoples of the Amazon, who in many cases they're not poor at all. They're not hungry. They're not poor. They're living in the rainforest. They have everything that they need. They don't have any money. They don't even understand money in some cases. They say you can't hunt for it. You can't eat it. Why would you even want it? What is all the fuss about this stuff? And their security is in the community. The good of the community is the highest good. They don't individuate the way we do. So the individual is responsible to the community, and the community nourishes the individual. So in all of these settings, I'm just sort of telling you that I've learned that even though I was gifted and with privilege, and now I really, really want to acknowledge that, and I've been unpacking, actually, my whole life since I realized that, the consequences, the dark consequences of unearned privilege that I was born into, given that I'm white, given that I lived in a community that was one that was middle to upper class, there are consequences, dark ones, to white privilege, to unearned privilege, that I think all of us who have been given that need to face. It's a gift. It's also a curse. So I act because there's a blindness, a real serious blindness that comes with that, that I think we all need to deal with. And when we talk about the Awakening the Dreamer Symposium, which is this program of the Pachamama Alliance that you referenced in our introduction, one of the things that we're really addressing now in the next iteration of that program is how to really deal with the consequences of privilege, particularly white privilege, because it may be what drives the dream of the modern world that we're all addicted to, whether we're white, black, yellow, brown, privileged or not, that we need to let go of now, that we need to release and create a new dream that's environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, and socially just for all people. So, I think there is a kind of invisible privilege, I'll say, or invisible advantage to people who have had to go through great tribulations and prevailed, that they have composted, not everybody, of course, but many people have composted that horrendous, those challenges. And it's given them a kind of strength and resolve and power that we're seeing now in the Middle East, for example. People who would stay in the streets knowing that their life is in danger, that they could get killed, they could get imprisoned, but somehow staying out there. I mean, my God, when you think about that, holy moly, where does that come from? And in many ways, it comes from the strength that is developed out of composting oppression and facing it day in and day out and finding a way through to care for your family, to stay in touch with your heart and soul. And I've seen that over and over and over again in the work that I've done in what most people call the less developed world. I call it the less consuming world. So we all have this opportunity now. There's nobody who's exempt from it. And you don't need to be privileged, and you don't need to be someone who's got financial space to get in the ballgame here. In fact, many of the people who don't have any of those advantages are some of the strongest, most resilient people on earth. And I bow to them. In the Hunger Project, we used to say, it's not that there are a billion mouths to feed or a billion people who are hungry that we need to help. There's a billion people, men, women, and children, standing on the front lines of the end of hunger with enormous courage. And it's our privilege to join them, to partner with them as co-equal partners in that challenge, in that fight, in that transformation.
What a beautiful way to complete this portion of our time together, Lynn. There's actually a lot here. I'd love to just kind of plunge in and go a little further in our dialogue, but I know there are a lot of folks who are participating with us live right now who probably want to offer their questions and engage with you. So let's take a pause here. I have a couple of important announcements. But meanwhile, if you have a question for Lynn or for me, simply send us your question via the instant message window in the instant teleseminar page on your computer. And if you've dialed up by the phone, please press *2 on your keypad to raise your hand. And please know if you press it again, it will lower your hand. So just press it one time. First, I want to tell you about the Integral Incubator. If you have an important idea or project in your life that needs a jump start, maybe it's the new business you've dreamed of starting or an important initiative for your job or company, or a creative project like writing a book or a website, a blog, or a screenplay, or maybe you'd just like to press reset on your whole career and develop an entirely new vision for yourself, consider attending the Integral Incubator, a 5-day boot camp in Boulder, Colorado, where you'll work with Ken Wilber, Jeff Salzman, and an expert team of Integral coaches to make your dream a reality. Upcoming Integral Incubators start on March 18th and June 29th, and you can find out more about the Integral Incubator at integralincubator.com. That's integralincubator.com. And now I have an announcement. I'm going to be offering a free 75-minute teleseminar this Thursday at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. It's titled The 3 Essential Practices of an Integral Spiritual Life. Real change can seem hard, but it's certainly not impossible. And gradually but profoundly, our lives can be transformed, especially if you have a deeply fulfilling and heart-centered daily spiritual practice that you can actually sustain over time. We're living in a time of extraordinary change in which connecting regularly to your radical source of courage and clarity and creativity is not just a nice thing to do. It's really a matter of survival and of thrival, of living a life of meaning and purpose. So you're invited to help co-create a community of integral evolutionaries who will be coming together on Thursday to go deep in service of evolving our world. It begins with a free teleseminar. What I'm doing here is developing a step-by-step course that will help people ground themselves in a heart-centered daily practice that's truly integral, one that draws not only on ancient wisdom but also on modern science, and one that's streamlined and essentialized and flexible. So I'll be introducing you to the three essential practices you can use to authentically change your life. There's awareness, the power of the heart of intelligence; trust, the power of the heart of feeling; and action, the power of the heart of choice. And taken together in an integral spiritual practice, they're the most integrated leading-edge form of practice I know of. So please watch for an email that will probably be coming tomorrow. It'll give you the code you need to register, and then you can join me at no charge this Thursday at 5:30 Pacific time. And if you register, you'll also be able to download the recording free of charge and listen at your convenience. I hope to join you again in just 4 days. Also, please stay on the line, and at the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our Beyond Awakening guests. Andrew Harvey will be joining us in 2 weeks on March 6th. We'll also be having a dialogue later in March with Michael Dowd, Roger Walsh, Candace O'Denver, and A.H. Almas, also known as Hamid Ali, the founder of the Diamond Heart School, will also be joining us. And then we'll open up the line so we can hear some of each other's voices as we say goodbye. So, let's see. Who do we have with questions? Let's see. We have, the question I had selected has disappeared. What happened? Bill in Santa Cruz asks, so often today's solutions create tomorrow's problems. How do you really know that our best intentions are aligned with what's emerging? I believe that I think we can believe we're doing good, but in fact inadvertently don't. Like, consider so many missionaries who thought they were doing good work, but also created, you know, outbreaks of diseases that killed thousands of people and other outcomes that were deeply traumatizing. I'm not quite satisfied, he's essentially saying, with the first round of discussion of that question. Would you like to go deeper to respond to that, Lynn?
I'll say what I can about that. I think that's the way it goes. I actually think that's the unfolding of history. You can look all the way back as far as you want to go, and that is the pattern. That is the way we do it. We make big mistakes, and then we resolve them, and then we have new problems. I don't mean to forgive us for things where we deliberately did harm, but I also think that the job in every generation, but particularly now, is to hospice the death of the old structures and systems that no longer serve us, that maybe looked like they would, and maybe did for a while even. But hospice their natural death, especially those that are unsustainable. Unsustainable means they will not last, so they are dying. And while we midwife the birth of that which we can now see is useful and important and relevant and nourishing for our time, And so we're always hospicing, we're always midwifing. If we're really awake, we're realizing, oh, that was great for a while, but that's no longer appropriate. That doesn't meet our needs anymore. In fact, that's starting to cause harm. And now we need to reframe, rethink, recreate from a new place of wisdom, a new knowledge, and bring forth what does serve us now, what is appropriate for our time. And so I totally agree. You know, I worked in places where missionaries did horrible things. I mean, I can't even kind of begin to tell you. At the same time, I also, in those same places, people learned to read who wouldn't have learned to read, even though they learned to read things that, you know, forced them into a mindset that perhaps I wouldn't have wished on them. But there were some benefits. So you validate that which works, and you hospice that which does not, and keep sorting. I mean, I think that's the process of life. Nobody has ultimate wisdom. Nobody really knows. But that doesn't mean we don't get out there and do our best and bring whatever we can to everything with as much responsibility as possible and take responsibility for our mistakes when we see something was taking us in the wrong direction, transform it and go forward. Otherwise, we get completely immobilized. And I think that's a worse sin than going forward and making mistakes and then going back and correcting them. So I it may not satisfy you, but I think that's the dance of life, and that's the way I see it. And so I'll just leave it there. But I really appreciate the question. It's a constant quandary for me too, and I respect the pushback. I really respect it, and I have it myself.
Yes, this is really something that's come up again and again in the Beyond Awakening series, that sometimes we stand in something where there's an enduring, deep dynamic that we have a practice to stay with and deepen in relation to, that we don't have final answers or good enough answers to important questions, but by persisting in caring and looking more deeply, we are part of a process through which better answers or better possibilities might evolve. We've come to that in a number of the earlier discussions. It seems like, in a way, you're saying, yes, this does matter, but, I got a chance to scan a bunch of the questions. There's actually been quite a flood of very wise and interesting questions that have arrived, far more than we'll have a chance to directly respond to, but a whole cluster of them are asking us, how can we deal with the things at a systemic level? Mm-hmm. Some people have pointed to the four quadrants of integral theory, that looking at the inner life of individuals, the cultural changes that need to go on in the inner lives of us as a collective, that the direct actions of individuals, but also the systems and structures that operate, all of those things need to be taken into account, and that some of the kinds of growth that need to go on are transformational. They involve us growing to another level, that somehow the kind of thinking we're engaged in may need to take a leap, and that even our best shot at a certain level of thinking isn't so much the point, maybe, that we need to outgrow that whole kind of mind. And I think people are inspired to act, but also inspired maybe to go deeper so that their contemplation arrives them in a way of acting that they feel might be more profound or more effective in a bigger way. And I'm feeling the care behind that impulse, you know, I feel that that's in tension with a very important truth you've offered, which is, yes, but action. You know, even if it's wrong, standing in your dilemma and being neutralized is not okay either. So spend some time really contemplating this deeply, and periodically contemplate it more deeply, but don't let that keep you from engaging and doing whatever you can, the best you can.
Yeah. I think we work a lot out in the action as well as in contemplation. And I would say to be mindful of not reacting but responding. I think those two things are very, very different. So reaction is a trigger, and responding is the capacity to deeply respond. And then a lot gets worked out in the action. It just does. Just think about being a parent. I mean, nobody really knows how to be a mother or a father, but once you have a kid, you've got to do it. And you can't, you know, wait until you're ready. Maybe you can wait until you're ready to have a baby, perhaps, but then when you have a baby and you have a child, you really have to work it out in the action. And you look back and, oh, I made a mistake when they were 9 and 10. I should have done this or that. It's just the way life works. But in the action, if we're true to ourselves, if we're authentic, if we keep telling the truth, that's where we learn. That's where we grow. And I totally agree that if you're coming from a more profound place, you'll do a much better job to respond rather than react, is another way of saying it. So I'm with you on that. And, you know, God, it's hard, but it's what a joy to be in the game.
Yes. How exciting that we're alive at a time when what we do matters, and mm-hmm. what a tremendous responsibility that is. It both deepens us, but we can't let it make us so heavy that we're immobilized. I appreciate your you know, I love spending this time with you, Lynn. I feel you're in this question with us, and that humanity is you know, you both teach and open, and thank you for that. We have a question, a live question, from Hall, Massachusetts, S. Sullivan. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Please let us know your name.
My name's Sheila.
Hi, Sheila.
Hi.
Hi, Sheila.
Lynn, I want to tell you I feel blessed to have listened to your conversation today. Sorry for being emotional. But I grew up in an amazing place where the families were poor to the absolute ultra-rich. So I certainly deeply appreciate you explaining to people what it's like to be privileged and white. I grew up in a Portuguese fishing family, and I have friends that have lived their lives on with trust funds. I'm in a position right now... and no one's more surprised than me that I've ended up here, to cause a paradigm shift in thinking in an entire medical community. I'm leaving on March 19th to fly to London to present research that I've done for 37 years, more specifically focused in the last 10 years, and I'm going to present give an oral presentation to an international group of physicians on research that I did on the cause of the onset of postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis. I am non-medically trained, and I am not a college graduate, so this is an incredible opportunity for me to share the profound understanding that I have learned about the human condition and help so many people come to a new understanding of the role that trauma plays on human health and the role that is involved in the onset of those conditions, and how so many people have been misdiagnosed with mental illnesses who are actually trauma victims.
Mm. Wow.
And I'm just one woman, and I reach out for support in a lot of different directions. I'm not vibrating in a great place of finances right now, though I have in the past. And I was so determined to get to this conference not having the money that I used my rent money to register for the conference, which would have put me in a very difficult situation. And then a friend reached out and provided me the funds to go to the conference.
Wow, good for you. Holy cow. Amazing.
Well, thank you, Sheila. That was a lovely story. I know there are lots of folks, and we don't have too much time, so I'm going to appreciate you and move on. We have another question here from, gosh, we've got lots of questions from Massachusetts today. Marjorie Slater in Boston, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you so much, Terry. Lynn, thank you so much for the most profound deepening call. I've read your book, The Soul of Money, and you always touch me when I pick up passages. My question is that my gift and service is around money, and I'm building a sort of a creating a foundational practice for others to work through. It's almost like setting up a recipe that others can do what they do. I come from an era when you touched on poor rich. I come from that too, and didn't have a lot of support. So I'm feeling that it's not only my practice and what I'm bringing forth, but how do I keep developing my confidence and courage in putting this forth and really let go of my upbringing? It seems to really dog me. It's almost like I brace for an onslaught of who do you think you are.
And did you have an upbringing that was poor? Did you say
and
poor,
rich?
What does that mean to you?
My father was sort of moderate to less, and my family was rich.
Uh-huh, I see.
So there was a big dichotomy, and I was always caught in the middle.
Yeah. And so you get a little shaky in your confidence. Is that what you're saying? It comes to haunt you?
Yes, it comes to haunt me, particularly when I'm working with bringing money processes forward, because that's what I love to do. My work is around money.
Yeah.
So I get caught in a three-way bind. Is that a little clearer?
Yeah. So yes, thank you so much. Well, my recommendation is to be authentic about your own struggle, because that's as much of a teaching as anything. I don't even know if I'm a teacher. I think I'm just a player, and then I share what's going on with me in a way that sometimes becomes useful to people. And if you're authentically in the struggle yourself and you're sharing your own struggle, you become much more authentically and humbly useful to other people. Then the other thing is whatever commitment you've made, this is something that I do anyway, I share it boldly with other people that I respect and ask them to hold me to account. And that boxes me in to my own greatness, if I can put it that way. You know, when I committed to being one of the people engaging in ending world hunger, that's a really pretty big commitment. But I didn't keep that to myself. I really stood for it and said it to many, many, many people. And then that declaration, that field of having spoken myself as my word, boxed me into becoming the kind of person who could actually fulfill that kind of a commitment. And so often it's giving your word in a way that people you respect and love and who can stand with you and for you hear you and are the committed, what was often called the committed listeners for that, boxes you in to get through your own stuff to fulfill it and to share authentically. You know, I'm committed to this no matter what, and what's coming up for me is my background and my shame about this and my upset about that, but by God, I'm going through it. I'm transforming it. This is how it's now showing up for me. So authenticity, for me, is the key path that I would recommend.
Okay, we have a question from Marvin Mattis in Crestone, Colorado. He says, I'm 80 years old, retired from major entertainment and industry corporations, and I have a lot of skills, but I'm in a type Z retirement environment. And there are a lot of us. I have leadership skills that take root wherever I am, but nowhere to take them, even in this small mountain town where I currently live. All of us idle ex-executives could together make a huge difference in the world. Do you have any advice for me?
Yeah, thank you. I love that question. Well, first of all, let me just say the coolest thing that's happening right now, I think, is the intergenerational power that we have at our fingertips in today's world. I really cannot function effectively in the work that I'm doing without being a co-equal partner with people in their 20s, in the millennial generation, because they know and understand the world of the digital world that is really making everything happen. And I am, you know, I'm in a generation where I'm just desperate to catch up and know I never will. So I just partner with them. So one thing that I just wanted to say, and this is, gives me, your question gives me the opportunity to stick this in here, is the power of us being peers, people who are in their 80s, I'm in my 60s, with people in their 20s and 30s and in their teens, because we really need each other now. They need wisdom, we need their technological skills, we need their worldview, and they need our experience, they need our life lessons. And Buckminster Fuller was one of my great teachers, said something really amazing to me about my own children that I always share whenever I can, and that is to know that our children and our grandchildren are our elders in universe time. They've come into a more complete, more evolved universe than we can understand except through their eyes. So at the same time, while we are elders, they're elders in universe time, we're elders in experience. So anyway, I wanted to say that. So let me just say, in direct practical answer to your question, there's something called the Eldering Institute. You can go online and connect with a man named Jim Selman, who's written a book called The Elder, has something called the Eldering Institute. His goal is to really have people in your age group connect with the great challenges of our day and bring wisdom and experience and power to the quick-minded, swift, almost faster than we can believe movement of the great issues of the world today. And you might find a place for yourself with his guidance or the work of the Eldering Institute. Secondly, I don't know if you're facile on the web. You may not be, and if you're not, then this won't be relevant. But if you are, that world is ageless. That world is colorless, that world is classless. The opportunity to participate with anyone and anything is at your fingertips if you have access to the digital world. So if you do, I would go there, and if you don't, or if you aren't facile there, as I'm learning to be more facile myself, partner with one of these millennial people that's age 15 to 35. Because they live there, and there is everything at your fingertips there. And then finally, really honor, I would say, the power of your deep wisdom that comes with being 80 years old. Brother David is in his 80s, as I said, and his website, gratefulness.org, will also give you access to projects and programs that will allow you to rest in the gratitude of the life you've lived in a way that it spills over and contributes to other people. So those are three things that that I can say in response to your wonderful question.
Wonderful. Well, Lynn, there are a whole flood of questions here. One of them, maybe we could have brief answers to a few so we can cover just a few more before we run completely out of time.
Okay.
Miriam Haar from St. Martin in the French West Indies says, "Hi, Lynn, as a fundraiser, could you give me a couple of tips about how to raise funds in a small community on a small island in the Caribbean for a project I've started to help house homeless, often mentally challenged people? It would be nice to get a few tricks on how to motivate the potential givers. Thank you."
Well, so this is like an answer I could give for, you know, 3 days, but I'll just give my the three rules of fundraising. Number one, ask for the money. And a lot of fundraisers never do that. They're afraid to ask for the money, but at some point you've got to ask for the money. Number two, ask people who are committed, who want to make a difference with their life, and who want to leave the planet better than they found it. That's rule number two. Ask people who are committed, who want to make a difference with their life and want to leave this planet better than they found it. And then the third is ask everyone, because everyone is committed, but they've forgotten and they're not in touch with it. Everyone wants to make a difference with their life, and everyone wants to make this planet better than they found it. Those are the three rules of fundraising. That's the fast answer I can give you. There's no one who doesn't want to make a difference with their money, and there's no one who's not a philanthropist. The word philanthropy means love of humankind. You don't have to be wealthy to be a philanthropist. You just need to be alive and breathing. And so ask, and ask with heart, authenticity, and in a way that honors people, and be totally fine if they say no. And if you keep asking with heart and authenticity and in a way that honors people, eventually the money that you need will come.
Beautiful. That was a very pithy answer. Thank you. there are a whole cluster of questions from people who have this story about Brian Hansel really stirred up a lot, because many people have read in various places that, for instance, the electricity that will power those vehicles may be created by burning coal, that there are complexities to the whole system behind all of this, that, you know, for instance, Jackie Bergman from Stockholm points out that all of this is part of an economic system that's based on infinite expansion in a planet with finite resources, and as long as everything is fitting into that, we're swimming against a bigger tide. There are other people who are saying, this is a fantastic story. I want to tell it to other people. How can I get, is there a place where this is posted, or is there a, have you blogged about it, or is there a video or an audio of what you presented? So it stirred up people in a lot of different directions, and I want to give you an opportunity to respond in a general way to all that.
In terms of the energy questions, I will leave those on the table for others who are energy experts to talk about. From what I learned at this meeting, making this conversion with thousands and thousands and thousands of trucks will make a huge difference. It may be that it's in some system larger than itself, and I know that it is. But I still know, I can feel that it's a big and important step. So that's my view of that. Number two, I'm going to tell this story on the 4 Years Go website. And I invite everyone here to go to the 4 Years Go website. You spell out F-O-U-R, Years Go, because it really was in many ways stimulated and activated by the 4 Years Go communication, although he was on this path and then he just ramped it up. And there'll be a little video of him speaking and a video of me talking about my experience of being there. It'll take a few days to get it up there. But I also invite you to go there and sign up yourself, take your own stand, register yourself on the 4 Years Go website, all of you, so that you're counted in this 4 Years Go growing momentum. And then go back there in a few days, and this story will be up, and you'll be able to send it to other people.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. And there's such a juicy question. I want to make sure we have time for this. Matthew in Crested Butte says, "Wow, Lynn," and I think he's referring here to that quote from Pema Chodron, "in your practice of opening to everyone and every situation. Would you speak more about how you are participating with those you meet in any random moment? How do you live that? And when you're living that, what kinds of questions might you ask of someone in that mode of opening completely?"
Oh, God. Oh, my goodness. Well, I'll just kind of telltale than myself. You know, sometimes I'm interacting with someone. If you read my book, the story about Mother Teresa is a perfect example of this, where some very unattractive, rude, and bossy people entered my meeting with Mother Teresa, and I didn't open to them. So if you read that, you'll know how I don't do it. But what I learned from her and what I've learned is that when I'm interacting with someone and they're nasty or they're mean or they're critical of me or they're critical of what I'm up to and I want to shut down and shut them out, or they're being obnoxious or there's something about them I don't like, in those situations I go out of my way to open to those people. And I know it's really hard to do that because sometimes they're really at no kidding, they're like a jerk. If I can open myself to somebody like that, I can do anything. And I learn from that every single time. So in my daily interactions at the cleaners, if someone cuts me off in traffic, am I going to curse at them, or am I going to say in my mind, what a jerk, or am I going to say, be open to, you know, gosh, I have some, my heart goes out to that person, they're just in a rage today. If I can do that, you know what, it sounds corny, but I'll tell you, it is so powerful. If I can give and receive love in every interaction, even in the ones that are mean and unkind, and when I find myself, when you find yourself getting upset or angry, or, you know, with your spouse or with your child or with your boss, and your body starts to close down and you start to feel that thing, it's very physical, and you relax and open your heart to that person and really realize, God, they're having a bad day, or they're upset about something that has nothing to do with me, or say to them, you know, gosh, I feel the edge and anger that you're directing at me, and I, you know, I just really want to say I'm sorry for that, and let's work out what it is. I don't know. It's really hard, but the more you do it, the more you learn, I don't know, everything that everybody's teaching. And it's available every day 10,000 times. So I don't know if that's clear enough, but that's really my answer. And it's, you know, it's a daily, it's part of every single day, many, many, many times a day. And I really realize what a gift it is, rather than what a bother it is, what a gift it is to have those constant opportunities to keep myself open, even when people are being, you know, really, really nasty or mean or discrediting or aren't paying attention or being jerks. And that's when you really find out who you are and what you're capable of.
Thank you so much, Lynn. That you embody that, and you're one of my models in doing that, and it's a wonderful reminder. And I feel like in that opening to one another and holding questions for which our answers are still provisional and need to evolve, and caring and acting and asking questions deeply and pressing further, we become something different together. And you're one of the dynamic leaders and models through whom I'm finding my way in this emerging new world that we're all co-creating. So a deep, deep bow to you. Thank you so much for spending this time with all of us.
Thank you, Terry. What a privilege and honor for me, and a total delight. Thank you so, so much, and thank you for the work you're doing that is critical to this time in history, critical to the world, critical to our future, and for being such an open-hearted, beautiful soul yourself.
Well, thanks so much. Please hang on just a minute. You'll be able to hear at least some of the voices. There are quite a few people joining us on the web. We can't hear them, but we can hear the folks who called in on the phone. In just a couple minutes, I'll open up the lines to say goodbye. So, everyone, you're invited to visit us on the web at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog or /Facebook. You can register if you're not already registered in your hearing list at beyondawakeningseries.com. My website is integralspiritualpractice.com, and please don't forget to look for the email that will come, I think, tomorrow, announcing my free teleseminar on the 3 essential practices of an integral spiritual life. And if you'd like to join me for that live, it'll be at 5:30 this coming Thursday, Pacific time, and then we'll be available via free download after that. And in 2 weeks, join me with Andrew Harvey and more to come. So thank you so much for joining Lynn and me today. Digo, please help us open up all our phone lines so that everybody can hear each other's voices and we can all say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
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 Thank you so much, Lynn.
Goodbye.